You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. Here we are in the studios of Radio Maria. Talking with the lawyer segment on Canadian immigration and citizenship law. It's our pleasure to speak to you today. We have, in previous sessions, in English, we've been trying to catch up, one could say, because the program has been done in Italian for over a year and a half, and we've actually recently started in English, and we started providing a complete background, knowledge is power, as they say, a background in terms of the historical context of Canadian immigration and citizenship law and the various practical issues that arise today and some of the changes in the law. And we've tried to do it on a wide basis so that people have a real good idea of the context of Canadian immigration and citizenship law, who is responsible for it under our federal system, and what exactly has been happening most recently. So we've provided that background now to all of our listeners, and we thought it would be important to actually deal with issues that are actually happening every day in the papers. We know that citizenship and immigration is really a hot-button item in Canada, in North America, in Europe, everywhere in the world. We are reading articles and listening to the news every day about stories, for example, even most recently from Myanmar, about the Rohingya refugees, Muslim refugees from a predominantly Buddhist country, where there seems to be obvious discrimination. So it's not just something here in North America or in Europe. It almost is a worldwide phenomenon. And every day we are seeing and reading and hearing about these issues. And in our Canadian context, we sometimes have to give our heads a shake and wonder, how does Canada all fit into this? What is actually going on? So we're going to, in the next a few segments that we go along and discuss with you, and eventually we'll encourage you to call in to us. We're going to try to look at these various issues and try to dissect them in order to make you understand the context and what's going on. Because unfortunately, a lot of our media today is Twitter and tweet and short sound bites and everything, and it's very difficult to try to get a grasp of the entire context in the light of Canadian, in particular Canadian immigration law and practice. And that's good, because when we know what's going on in Canada, we can have a better sense of what goes on overseas or somewhere else and how that fits into our own situation. Comparative learning is actually a very fine tool to have an understanding of a situation. And we all know that from understanding and from having a dialogue, even about different points of view, that we begin to perhaps understand different points of view, communicate, and perhaps even move things along in a very practical context. So in light of everything we've discussed before on a theoretical basis and under Canadian immigration law and practice and the federal government, this month of October, and in particular, the previous week, we finally were able to obtain hard copies and forms of the changes to the Citizenship Act. To those of you who may have been listening to us, whether it was in the Italian or the English language broadcasts, know that it was a promise of the current government to substantially reform Canadian immigration and citizenship law, particularly in the area of citizenship, to which has been the subject of some debate, and as a matter of fact, was actually held up in the Canadian Senate for almost a year. To show you how democracy works, the government over a year ago had proposed it and wanted to push ahead, and the senators, who are not elected officials, tried to give it a serious second look, perhaps bring out certain arguments or issues. Some of the minor changes were accepted and has now been implemented. And so it was announced that some very important changes would come into effect earlier this summer. I always call it the Canada Day announcements. It was roughly a week or so before Canada Day. But unfortunately, all these things have a practical aspect. You can't just change the law and snap your fingers tomorrow and expect everybody in the world, in Canada, to react immediately to the changes in the law. So it's taken a little bit of time to in fact, obtain the first what we call regulatory changes. And as a matter of fact, in this, one could say in the second week of October, we have now actually got the new immigration law forms, the citizenship law forms that are required in order to make an application for citizenship. So it has happened. It was announced that it would come into effect on October the 11th. It actually did come into effect on October 11th. The only problem was the people who programmed it created forms that nobody could access. There was a glitch in the computer systems. So it wasn't actually until October the 12th that we had brand new systems. And now many of us have clients who are looking to take advantage of the new law and to apply for citizenship as soon as possible. So it's a good idea to maybe, again, look very briefly at what exactly these changes are in citizenship law, which some of which took an effect, as I call them, the Canada Day changes, but actually received royal assent on June the 19th. What occurred on October the 11th was that the law changed very substantially. In a way, it's a callback to the law that previously existed before the Conservative government was in power for roughly 10 years in Canada. And at that time, the law provided that if you were resident in Canada, physically present in Canada, for 3 of the 4 years after landing, becoming a landed immigrant in Canada, you could apply to become a landed immigrant, a citizen of Canada, having been a landed immigrant. And also at that time, the law was that you could, for a maximum period of 1 year's credit, obtain 1 year's credit for every 2 days of physical presence that you were in Canada, even before you came a landed immigrant. So it was 3 and 4 and a 2-for-1 credit. So, for example, in the old days, as I will call it, more than 10 years ago, for a very long time, if, for example, you were married to someone who was not a Canadian landed immigrant or a citizen, and you sponsored them to come to Canada, and if the person was even here, perhaps as a student or a visitor or on a work permit, that person, if they didn't leave Canada from the time they got the landed immigrant visa after being sponsored successfully by a Canadian permanent resident or citizen spouse, would be able, after 2 years very often, to apply for Canadian citizenship. Why? Because if they never left 2 years after landing, they'd have 2 years of physical presence. And if they were here the 2 years before they landed in Canada, they would get credit for 1 year. Therefore, they would have a credit for 3 or 4 years physical presence in Canada. And of course, this marries very nicely with the idea that people who come to Canada, who we invite or encourage to come to Canada to become landed immigrants, come as soon as is reasonably possible citizens. We invite them not only to come live here, but to take part in the great dialogue of being in a Canadian society by becoming a citizen, because that is the big difference between a landed immigrant and a Canadian citizen. A Canadian citizen can vote. A landed immigrant cannot vote. And it's sort of what you have to do to really be part of the discussion. Otherwise, you're sort of your opinion is a little bit second rate, with the greatest of respect to people who think the citizenship doesn't matter, because you may live here, but you're not really committing yourself to this country. And so this was the old law. The Conservative government that was elected decided to change that law. They felt it was too generous, and they went to a system where, first of all, you could only apply for landed immigrant status after being a landed immigrant here for at least 4 years. And you had to be here, you had to have 4 years previous residence in the previous six. So you can appreciate that it's a much longer time period. They also changed the law so that they gave you absolutely no credit for having been here before you became a landed immigrant. So it was a much less generous provision. They also instituted all kinds of language and knowledge of Canada requirements that were much more difficult than existed previously. And the general tenor of that citizenship law during the tutorship of the Conservative government was a much more difficult process, and I would suggest to you a lot less welcoming process. So we move ahead to the federal government that's currently run by the Liberal Party, and one of their platforms was, in fact, to have a much more open and transparent and generous Canadian immigration and citizenship system. And to some extent, but so most certainly in the area of citizenship law, they have held true to their promises. So not all politicians make promises and then don't keep their promises. They actually did. And as lawyers, we have to give them credit for doing what they said they were going to do. So the latest change that came into effect on October 11th was that they now aligned the number of years that applicants needed to file the Canadian income taxes under the Income Tax Act to the 3 out of the 5 years to match the changes in the physical presence requirements. The previous Conservative government, in fact, had introduced a 4 out of 6 routine to match. So this was just an ordinary, one could call it a bookkeeping change, but it was a big change. And I've mentioned in various broadcasts that, unfortunately, because I've been practicing for 38 years, that I actually was witness in Hong Kong in one particular occasion from a Hong Kong businessman who at the Jockey Club in Hong Kong was literally crowing about having never been in Canada and getting his citizenship after 3 years, and how little control there was in Canada, basically, I would say, belittling the fact that the Canadian government at that time controlled who became a citizen and who didn't become a citizen. And I had many people in years gone by say to me, "Well, Mr. Martinello, why do I have to tell the truth about when I've been here? I have so many of my friends, or my paisani, as we say, who have not told the truth, never been caught, they became citizens, nobody knows the worst for it. And, you know, why do I have to bother with all this thing about telling the truth and doing all these things?" And, you know, and so aside from being a lawyer, I used to always tell them that every night that they went to bed, they should remember that if they get a knock on their door in the middle of the night and it's the RCMP, they're going to come to take them away. And people used to think it was a joke, but the truth was, and the law is and was and always has been, that anyone who obtains citizenship through misrepresentation and fraud is not entitled to citizenship. That citizenship can always be taken away, in addition to a number of other things like crimes against humanity. So we're talking here about Nazi people actively involved in genocide in World War II, number of cases. We're talking about the genocide that occurred in Rwanda. There are a number of Africans who had their citizens stripped of them because they failed to disclose their involvement with crimes against humanity. So this is actually a very serious issue. So unlike that Hong Kong businessman who was crying about it, I'm a lawyer, I couldn't report him to the government, but I thought he was rather stupid, because if you had one enemy in the room, all it would take would be one phone call, in fact, to begin an investigation, which is what the ERCMP does, the police do, with these things. The people who you really have to fear are your family and your friends and your ex-business associates, because they are the biggest sources of people to say, well, I know this guy, Mr. X, and he came to Canada, he never lived here, and he became a Canadian citizen without living here, and he obtained it through fraud. They're very happy to investigate people and to try to strip them of their citizenship. So that part of the law did not really change. But there was something about revoking citizenship that's very important. It's not in place yet, but it will be in place in the near future. And that has to do with who exactly is going to be entitling someone to get rid of their citizenship. The Conservatives basically, for most cases, wanted the Minister of Immigration to be able to do it. The present government has depoliticized it. They've announced and they have said, no, we have a professional court in Canada called the Federal Court of Canada, and they're going to make the decisions. We're not going to make it political. And I think this is a very good idea, because I don't think we want politicians, with the greatest respect to our politicians, deciding with some hidden agenda who is or is not entitled to be a Canadian citizen. I think we have a great deal of faith in our judicial system, that people do things according to the law, and therefore they are the best people to make those kinds of decisions. So this is very important. Some of the other changes that occurred that actually took effect on June 19th was that the citizenship could be revoked from dual citizens convicted of treason, spying, and terrorism offenses, depending on the sentence they received or were part of an armed force or a country-organized group engaged in conflict of Canada. This provision was repealed retroactively on June the 19th, 2017. There was actually only one person who was ever stripped of it, and he was before the courts going to the Supreme Court of Canada, where I think he would have won. But the current government just basically got rid of that idea and they changed the law. So now that provision is revealed, and dual citizens in Canada who are convicted in these kinds of crimes will face the Canadian justice system just like any other Canadian citizens who broke the law. So that is clearly the case. Then there was another change, was that they had placed this requirement in the citizenship law that applicants were required to intend to continue to live in Canada if granted citizenship. So this was very problematic. I'll give you a real simple example. Let's say that I've been living in Canada for 10 years, got my doctorate and working, and now I get offered an opportunity, and I can become a citizen tomorrow. I get offered an opportunity, maybe a professional opportunity, to go work for the Royal Bank in London, England, as maybe a vice president from Canada. Well, if I did that and I wasn't yet a citizen, they would question whether or not I really intended to live in Canada because I was living abroad. So the typical advice to a client would have been, you shouldn't leave Canada until you get your citizenship. And when citizenship applications were taking 1 and 2 years, we were asking these people to forego promotion or changes of life or whatever occurred just because of our law and this possibility of perhaps having citizenship not granted because some citizenship judge wondered whether or not we really intend to live in Canada. So this has been repealed. An applicant is no longer required to intend to continue in Canada once he's granted citizenship, and this removes the concern for new Canadians who may need to live outside of Canada for work or personal reasons. This is not an academic exercise. I have had a couple of clients right now, because of the old law, who are waiting, and we're going to be filing for them this month under the new law, because they do have some personal circumstances. One is a student doing a doctorate in Paris. Another one is a husband who's been offered a position, a very senior medical officer position, for a short number of years in the Mideast, and the family wants to take advantage of it, but they've been in Canada for many years. So this is not academic. So I think it's consistent with a great deal of generosity, but also transparency and pride of what we believe in Canada in terms of these things. Now, another change that is of some importance is that, which has existed, which still exists, is that the minister had always had discretion to grant citizenship to a person to alleviate cases of special or unusual hardship or to reward services of exceptional value of Canada. Right now, the minister can also do it for statelessness. These are people who basically have nowhere to go. You might say, who could they be? One time they were Vietnamese boat people. Today, if there were some Rohingya Muslims in Canada, they might be stateless people because Myanmar will not recognize them and they don't have any other citizenship. So at any event, this is one of the things that those were other issues that have changed, which are positive and reflect the humanitarian, compassionate nature of Canadian immigration law and consequently citizenship. The next thing I wanted to point out was in terms of the October 11, 2017 date is, aside from the physical presence test and the Canadian income tax filing, which I'm 100% in agreement with, is under the old law, the applicants had to be physically present in Canada for 183 days in 4 out of the 6 years preceding an application. That has also been removed. Now it is a 3 out of 5 year test. It's a 60% physical presence test. And for those of you that may be outraged and thinking that we're far too generous, I will point out to you that actually we're not very generous at all, because if I was a citizen of, if I was a landed immigrant or a green card holder in the United States, I can apply for my citizenship in the United States after being physically present only 50% of the time, 2.5 years out of 5 years, not 3 out of 5. So the United States is still more generous than what we are here in Canada in terms of obtaining citizenship. I also mentioned again, and I reiterate, that the time prior to obtaining your landed immigrant visa now counts. So immigrants can count each day they were physically present in Canada, for example, on a visitor visa or a protected person, before becoming a permanent resident, as a half day towards a physical presence requirement for citizenship, up to a maximum credit of 365 days within 5 years preceding the date of the application. This, once again, is a very positive aspect. I mentioned also before about knowledge of Canada and English. The previous law said that if you were between the age of 14 and 64, you had to meet language and knowledge requirements for citizenship. They wanted you to pass an English or French language test and a knowledge of Canada. Well, that wasn't the case before, I should tell you, under the law, and the law has now gone back to require language and knowledge requirements for citizenship for people between 18 and 54. Once again, quite generous. Now, you might say once again, oh, that's ridiculous, Mr. Martinello. Are you telling me that somebody who's 55 years old can't speak English so well and doesn't know anything about Canada? You'd be surprised how many people there are in Canada, through no fault of their own except maybe their inability to learn a second language, but are otherwise very well established in Canada. I always talk on my radio broadcasts in Italian about a client of mine who was Portuguese, who was like a Finnish carpenter and par excellence. He was just incredible. And the problem with this gentleman was, as wonderful he was, and he made $100,000 a year doing all the very fancy homes in Forest Hill and lots of fancy places in Toronto. But for the life of him, he had a mental block. He was a great carpenter, but he couldn't learn English. He didn't have to worry about learning English. Everybody else either spoke Italian or Portuguese, or we all know that, because in the construction sites, if you don't speak more than one language, you're in big trouble, you know? It's a very helpful tool. And so this gentleman, although he was well established and made money, he would never have passed an English test. He probably knew a lot about Canada, but only in Portuguese. And he always was so ashamed to never apply for it to become a citizen. It was the silliest thing. But he, and the funny thing, what the whole ironic thing was, is that his wife, who was with him, who was also Portuguese, by the way, she spoke English fluently. She worked full time. His daughter, who spent a fair number of years growing up in Canada, she spoke English and Portuguese fluently. And she was a university graduate. So the two of them could become Canadian citizens, but poor old dad, who was the key motivating factor to have them come in Canada, he was treated in a second-rate manner. I hate to say it, but he was, because he had this mental block. He would be the classic case that I'm describing right now of a gentleman that at least when he hits 55, that he can do it. And if you think that it's just carpenters and people like that, you're wrong. I have a Roman Catholic priest who's a client and a friend of mine. He also doesn't speak English well enough, and he just turned 55, and he is the happiest guy in the world, because I told him this a couple of weeks ago that he's now going to be able to apply as a Canadian citizen. His English is okay, but it's not great, I must tell you. And he loves Canada. He loves being here. I think he would even pass a test on the knowledge of Canada, but not in English, because he wouldn't understand the language of a lot of the political and cultural things. So he, too, is going to become, he'll be standing in line and next week, I'm sure, to try to become a Canadian citizen. He's very happy. So it's not just people that we think of as uneducated or whatever. These are usually people who are well-established, and they actually want to become Canadian. And I think all of us who are listening may be more, you know, we may be second, third, first, fourth, fifth generation Canadians. We probably all have friends from different parts of Canada. And we know people like my mother-in-law who, she's 90 years old this year. She never became a Canadian citizen. Why did she never become a Canadian citizen? Because, once again, she never learned English. She watched the broadcast. She understood English. I think she knew more politically than most young people today know about the country and so on. But she always said it was always a bit of a sense of embarrassment, because her crime, for want of a better word, was that she raised three daughters and took care of her family at home. And traditionally, this kind of law discriminated traditionally against women whose crimes, again, I'm using the word very loosely, was that they were stay-at-home moms and did a good job at raising their children, who, of course, are all very well integrated into Canadian lifestyle. So all of these people now, if they choose to, now can say, okay, I'm going to step up and also become a Canadian citizen. I think it's a great great change in the law that is way, way overdue. I mentioned previously also, I want to reiterate that the changes that are going to be coming, you'll see them coming at the end of this year, early next year in 2018, that the federal court will become the decision maker in all revocation cases unless the individual requests that the minister makes the decision. And the minister was the decision maker for most cases of citizenship revocation on the grounds of false representation, fraud, and knowingly concealing material circumstances. Although the federal government was the person that were the entity that decided citizenship revocation cases, that involved false representation, fraud, or knowingly concealing material circumstances relating to security, human, or international rights violations, and organized criminality. And that is, in a really brief summary, the changes that have occurred, the changes that were promised, the changes that have been talked about. They've taken a couple of years, but they're now firmly in place. So if you have people that you know that are friends and colleagues or family members who have heard about it, the law has changed. And during this past 2 years, we actually saw the number of applications for citizenship drop because the changes were announced, were part of the election platform, but it's taken some time to have the law be implemented. And so a lot of people have quite rightly concluded, we used to tell all of our clients, you're best to wait till the law changes because the new law will be faster and will be more expeditious than go through this whole 4 to 6 year routine. And are you intending to live in Canada or not? And to wait on it. And so a lot of people, we've seen the number of applications drop from like 225,000 to 100,000 in the last year. But we expect the numbers will probably shoot up. And we should tell you that it's not cheap to become a Canadian citizen. The costs have gone up. Many years ago, they were $100. Now it's like $500 per person plus $100 right of citizenship fee. So we're actually asking people to put a fair bit of money up to become a Canadian citizen. And so it's not cheap. So you shouldn't think it's a free ride. As a matter of fact, we as lawyers who have analyzed it have figured out that, in fact, all the money that they're going to make off the citizenship applications, and the government's pretty much said so, and the bureaucracy said so, they're going to make more money than what they will need to, in fact, run the citizenship department. That's the bottom line. And they're going to apparently use the excess funds to make the system more efficient. They're even thinking of moving through a secure system of users to an online system, at least for initial input. And all these things are incredibly expensive. So actually, all the new Canadian citizens are actually going to be paying for the new changes as we go along. And they're going to be paying a substantial amount of money to come to Canada, in addition to maybe the legal fees that they'll be paying lawyers and registered immigration consultants to help them not to make mistakes. Because people are so worried about making mistakes, given the bureaucracies that we have, that they want everything to be handled properly. And that can be done by lawyers, and I would suggest to you lawyers who are specialized in immigration law, and licensed immigration consultants. So this is a very brief summary of the changes in the citizenship law. And we're going to take a bit of a break now, and then we're going to move on, and we're going to talk. I'm going to mention to you now some of the great changes that were happening, or I don't know how great they are, but certainly they're in the news with respect to citizenship law and how they fit into the whole context of what we've discussed in the past about immigration law. Thank you, Nick. We're back in the studio. We had finished discussing about the recent changes in Canadian citizenship law. We're going to move ahead now and discuss a little bit about Canadian immigration law and some of the things that are happening in the news not only in Canada, but in the United States. As I said, it's important when we see these things in the news to understand the background and what's going on, and it makes our appreciation of the facts and what's going on a little bit more transparent. You know that I've said in the past that we're taking in about 300,000 people a year. One of the announcements of the Minister of Immigration and Citizenship for Canada recently was that 300,000 has now become a baseline. And it's very important. Yeah, politicians use these little words. They're like feelers, you know? I can tell you right now, nobody has really thought to, except for us lawyers, have thought about what the word baseline means. That really means a minimum. In many of my broadcasts, I've discussed, given the demographics in Canada of a declining birth rate, in general terms, the boomer generation, the aging of Canada, the 36 million population, the goal to move Canada towards around 60 to 65 million people, probably over 50 years, to create a country that has a lot more economies of scale in many respects and to be more efficient, requires, we know about, on the basic present statistics, about 1% annual increase in the Canadian population just through to external immigration. There's also people inside Canada who leave or return back home. There's a number, go to the U.S., go to Mexico, wherever. And so if you think about the math, 36 million is 360,000 per year. So I expect, in fact, we're going to see the numbers move more towards 350,000 people. And the question will be, and I know people are always concerned, and so, you know, Radio Maria or Radio Maria is the voice of Catholic radio in Canada, okay? And so whether you like it or not, my views are more aligned with the Pope, okay? Not with the church in Canada. I'm going to go right to the top. The Pope and I think a lot alike. So if you don't agree with us, too bad. We can have a nice discussion about why the Pope and I think about the same ways in so many things. And he's not even a lawyer. He's a Jesuit, though. So, you know, the Jesuits were the intelligentsia of the church. Let's not kid ourselves. But he's the first pope who is the Jesuit. So that may say something, even though he's a tremendously pastoral man. He's a very humanitarian, compassionate person. He didn't choose the name Francis. Hello, Francis, everybody out there, remember who Francis is. It's Saint Francis. You could count on your hand, I call them the bigwigs in the Catholic Church. And I'm not being facetious when I say that. There are the big saints, the great saints. They are Saint Francis. They are, maybe today for us, they're Padre Pio. Maybe they're Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Maybe they are Pope now, Saint John Paul II. They are for sure Saint Francis. Maybe Saint Thomas Aquinas. But these are really what I call the heavyweights of the Catholic Church. And he's chosen that name. And he's chosen that name because he wants to have a pastoral and humanitarian compassionate face to the Church. Now, we can all be critical of the Catholic Church and its history and everything else that's going on. We're not hiding everything. Everybody knows the history. But the church, we know, is to some extent, but certainly was in the past, a lot more a temporal institute. And it had its own warts and failures and everything else. But when we talk about the Catholic Church today, and the person who's the spiritual leader, he is the Pope. And he is, I think, by all accounts, a person who's been tremendously humble. He's been tremendously humanitarian. He's reached out to the Jewish faith, the Muslim faiths, the Orthodox Church. Do people know that the head of the Orthodox Churches hadn't sort of met or talked to the Pope for a few hundred years? I mean, can you imagine that? This is a Christian church. He's tried for a greater rapprochement, for example, with the Lutheran Church. Because in case people don't realize it, Luther was saying a lot of very good things about the excesses of Catholicism at his time over 400 years ago. So this is someone who's been open to ideas and exchanging and to communicating with people in a very humble way. And so a lot of citizenship law, you'll see in the press that he is a big, big proponent of what we would call today social justice, to having people being treated humanely no matter what their background. So you'll, for example, you'll see the Pope praying and asking for, we would call, rapprochement towards the Rohingya Muslims who are refugees in Myanmar and the adjoining properties. He doesn't care. We're not just talking about Catholics. We also all know about the horrible problems in Pakistan with Christians who are greatly discriminated against. He talks equally. He cuts across the whole phase of whatever's going on. And that's a very big part of his message. And we have, in Canada, we have a humanitarian, compassionate message also. And you could say it's part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which we are part of. But one shouldn't think that of the 300 or 1,000 people that come to Canada, that we have 300,000 refugees. We're not. We didn't take 1 million people like Germany did from Syria a couple years ago. 1 million people, Germany. We took 30,000, and that made big headlines around the world because the United States was like taking 10,000. So we decided with the humanitarian crisis that there was in Syria, whether they were Christian or Muslim, that we should bring 30,000 people to Canada, which we did last year. And Canada was widely applauded for that. But that is not something that happens every year. That's probably the most we take in any given year. We take 15,000 to 30,000 people. So even though a lot of people on the street like to say, oh, they say there's all these illegal people and there's all these kinds of people and those kinds of people, the truth is quite the opposite. The refugees who are here and they have to go through an arduous process of being a refugee are probably no more than 15,000 to 30,000 people. They are controlled to see if they're criminals. They are controlled in terms of major health issues and so on. So this is a bit of an urban legend, as we would call urban myth, about that. But half of the people that come to Canada every year can't come in what we call the economic stream. What is the economic stream? The economic stream are people who come here under work permits, who come here perhaps as students who come and work. They may come as business people who have come here. These are actually people that Canada needs. Because of what I described before, low birth rate, jobs, expanding economy. By the way, now low unemployment rate. In Ontario, it's maybe 5%, which according to some economists is 0% in real terms because people are always changing jobs and looking for work. So these are all people who are contributing very positively, and they represent 50%, at least 50 to 60%. The other 40 or 50% that are coming to Canada, there's a little bit, 10% maybe are refugees. The other ones are people who are spouses and children of people who are already here. So like somebody who, I'll use the example, maybe immigrates to Italy, goes back home as a girlfriend, a boyfriend, whatever, and decides to bring them to Canada. This is also a part of our humanitarian tradition where we try to encourage families to be together. This is also part of the Christian message, by the way. And we know, actually, if one wants to be really, I would use the word almost economic about it, the truth is we also know that one of the standards for success, which is at the basis of all immigration law in Canada, the ability of the person to economically establish himself in Canada, we know that the support of family is a very big factor, so people can get on their feet and be helped out by their family when they come to Canada. It's a very big factor. And the second big factor, by the way, which immigration law reflects, is a good working knowledge of English and French as a general characteristic. I know I mentioned my Portuguese carpenter, and he's maybe a bit of an anomaly. But the truth is, a lot of the tradespeople don't have a great working knowledge of English and French, although they're, or French, but they have a good working knowledge of their trade, and most of them learn English or French after working here at a decent level, absent, you know, a real learning impediment. So this is the key to success for coming to Canada. There's family, there's educational skills, there's knowledge of English and French. And so all of our immigration policy is based on that. But half of it is really a true economic, I call it the economic class. Now, in our system in Canada, the economic class, the 90% of it, is all related to something called the Express Entry System. And I'm sure you've heard me in the past talk about what the Express Entry System is. It's not actually quick, and it doesn't easily allow you to come to Canada. It's like an oxymoron. It's, you know, an oxymoron in English is something that you say is a completely opposite of what it is. And that's what Express Entry is, because it's neither fast and it's always an impediment to having you coming in. It's not very easy. So as lawyers, we laugh about the choice of the words because of the obvious. But what it is, in essence, is that the people that, when I say we, when the bureaucrats analyze and we look at who we want or need to come into Canada to work, which is positive for all of us, and which you will recall is the stepping stone that we want them not only to come here and to work, but we want them to be a part of our social fabric and become citizens of Canada. The key issue is, how are they going to come and work here legally? This express entry system is a two-stage system. Stage one is what we call an invitation to apply. There's nothing guaranteed. It's an invitation to apply system. And you have to create a profile. And you have to keep it properly. And you have to do it online, by the way. And it has to be done properly. And it has to be kept updated. Because if you don't keep it updated, you may not get an invitation to apply. And if you don't do that, you're going to maybe not be able to really apply to become a landed immigrant of Canada. So this invitation to apply system has been worked out and wrinkled. And in the beginning of October, the people who are in this pool, all the people who filed these profiles in this pool, who were around 438 points, were getting an invitation to apply. Now, what does that mean? That means that within basically 90 days, hopefully with the help of your lawyer or immigration consultant, you have to get all the paperwork together in a final format, and it has to be perfect because they're really fussy, these bureaucrats, that you will reach the 67 points. That's the magic number. And that's a combination of factors, age, education, language, work experience, and so on and so forth, to be able to get a landed immigrant visa, which does take about roughly 6 to 12 months once that happens. So the invitation to apply, the first step, the magic number is about 438 people. And if we look over this last year, we can see that roughly every week we're issuing about 2,500 invitations to come and apply. But the number is stabilizing. The lowest was about 413. It's never really dipped now before 450. So we have an active pool of people that are available to apply. And there have been some changes recently that have made it maybe more advantageous to you to come here. There's been increased points for a second language like French. There's been increased points for having a sibling here. So people who have not been updating their express entry profiles maybe could get more points and actually get an invitation to come in. And a lot of people are amazingly ignorant that these things are going on all the time as they fine-tune the system in order to create this pool of people for whom there will be an invitation to apply. So that's the first stage of where we're at. And And this is going to be important because it's going to be the engine that will drive people coming to Canada in the next year. In my next broadcast in English, I'm going to continue to talk about express entry, coming to Canada, the points that are needed. I'm going to give you in the next episode, I'm going to give you some practical examples of how things are occurring and how people, in fact, are improving their chances to come to Canada, especially in the express entry system, which is designed for people who have established themselves economically in Canada, become landed immigrants in Canada today, which we really all do want them to become. So that's it for this broadcast. I'm going to turn the mic back over to Nick, and I want to thank you all for listening, and please do listen to us in English on our broadcast, which is usually the last Saturday of every month. Take care and have a great month.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.